When was the last time, how's this for a transition? When was the last time someone spoke something really hard to you? Really difficult to hear? Can you remember that? Something you didn't particularly want to hear, but either you needed to hear it or they thought you needed to hear it. And Lord knows those two things are not always the same, right? It's quite a journey sometime. To think about this. I want to tell you about the king Manasseh. Manasseh was just terrible. Manasseh reigned for 55 years over the Hebrews in the 600s BC. He was the worst king ever. Manasseh forgot or chose not to acknowledge the identity that the Hebrew people had in their God Yahweh. And so what he did was he allowed the values of the culture around him to just completely take over the identity that his people once had. He encouraged pagan worship. He brought idols of Baal into the temple of God where things dwelled side by side. And what was once a beautiful temple to the one true God became just like any of the other temples, filled with idols. He brought in wizards and sorcerers that kind of imprisoned people in superstition and in ritual. 2 Kings describes this guy's wickedness, 2 Kings 21. He even burned his son on the altar in a grotesque act of worship in front of his people. This is the world into which Jeremiah was born. This is the world into which the prophet Jeremiah was called. Okay, we said that last time, but we had to bring it in again. Jeremiah is the prophet that we're looking at right now. He's not a bullfrog, but we've begun looking at what it means to enter into the world just for a couple weeks of Jeremiah, to be a courageous prophet. Last week, we looked at Jeremiah's courageous calling. Though he was going into a world that was totally beyond his capacity and comfort that God had called him into, God spoke words of identity. I am with you. I know you. Even though you are imperfect, even though you think that you are not up for the task, even though you feel inadequate, you are known, you are desired, you are able to be used in spite of that inadequacy. And God gave him visual reminders of what that looked like throughout his life. This week we look at a second element of courage in Jeremiah's life, and that is being courageous in critique. Critique can be defined as bringing to light the reality of missing the mark, okay? When you critique something, you look at maybe where it has gone astray. The word for sin in the Bible in Greek is hamartia, and it's an archery term, and it means to miss the mark, to miss the bullseye. So there's a goal, there's a hope, and it looks like this mark, and the hamartia was used in archery when that arrow would miss the mark. And so that's the image that we get in terms of God's heart. God has a hope for how we live toward other people in the world, for the state of our own hearts, for the type of relationship that we are intended to have with God. And any time that we miss that mark, it's called sin. And so critique in the biblical way, in the way that the prophets did, critique often happened as a way of calling people's attention to where they had missed the mark, often by radical self-deception. Often this was not mistakes people had made. This was knowingly moving away from what was good and true and beautiful in the world. And so critique can happen to an entire group of people, to a culture even, or to individuals. Most often in the scriptures, critique comes to the, you guessed it, religious folks. Over and over again, the critique in the scriptures is pointed, whether you're looking at the Old Testament or the New Testament or the early church even, is pointed at the religious folks, the ones who should know God, the ones who should have an idea of what that bullseye looks like because it's been given to them, it's been taught to them, it's been told to them. And like I said, most often it's not about mistakes being made, but a blatant disregard for right ways of living. This idea of critique, I step in front of you with a little bit of fear and trembling because this is a very, very difficult subject to talk about for a couple reasons. First, critique is so incredibly difficult to receive. Many of you know that. And we know this anecdotally, right, from our own experience. Because there are times where you will hear something from someone, hopefully it's someone that you love and that loves you, and there's a trusting relationship, but you will hear something that is a critique that you know is true, even. And it is so incredibly difficult to accept. Because we are all of a sudden faced with our own vulnerability, our own fallibility, our own fact that we are not perfect. We all know this, but nobody likes to see it right in front of us. And often we realize that our actions have actually hurt another. And that's, so we've got shame, we've got guilt. I mean, it is just super hard to receive critique well, right? It's tough. So it's just very difficult to receive. Secondly, critique is often very painful to give. If our hearts are in the right place, critique is very painful to give because we feel like we might be risking relationship when we do it. And so to speak anything that might be acknowledging where something is missing the mark, we have to walk very, very carefully, and it's often very painful even to the one giving the critique. And finally, critique that is actually effective is difficult to navigate without damaging your cause. If the cause is to hopefully move toward righteousness, right ways of living, our critiques often don't actually end up there because they are seen as very offensive. They are seen in a light, they're just disagreed with, excuse me. There's so many things that simply make it hard to be able to have this whole thing work. That's why we need to talk about it. We're going to look at a couple instances in Jeremiah where Jeremiah had to give courageous critique, and then we're going to explore life on both sides of critique, okay? So I'm going to give a really brief overview of this, all right? I'm not going to do it justice on purpose because it'll get long and boring, and I really don't want to do that this morning because we have so many beautiful elements. So I'm just going to give a brief overview. Start by trusting me and then check it out for yourselves afterwards, okay? So this is just a little bit of the context of Jeremiah 7. So I told you about how Manasseh was just the worst dude ever. So in terms of his leadership, he just tanked Israel. They weren't doing great before, or Judah at this time. They weren't doing great before, but they certainly weren't doing good during his reign. After him, his son Amon came, and there was some hope. At the end of Manasseh's life, there was a couple times that he wanted to reform things and clean up the temple and everything, but he never really got around to it. He died before that happened. So Amon came, and there was this amazing hope about how Amon would do, but he only reigned for 2 years, and he was, like, worse than his dad. So he was really not good, very selfish. And then came his son. His son was named Josiah. And Josiah came, and Josiah was known as one of the bright spots in this time of the Hebrews, okay? In the time of Jeremiah's ministry, Josiah was the hope, okay? And so Josiah comes, and Josiah has an inherent innocence. He is a child when he inherits the throne, and when he's 16, his people discover, as they're cleaning up the temple, they discover the ancient scripture. They discover the book of Deuteronomy. They find it. They read it. Josiah is totally wrecked. He says, oh my goodness, we've lost our way. And so he starts to follow the book of Deuteronomy and starts to restore the temple and the temple practices how they should be. So this is a really good moment, right? We are moving in the right direction. The temple gets cleaned up. The idols are smashed and removed. And everybody is, you know, they follow Deuteronomy to a T. Josiah comes and goes, and we get to his son Jehoiakim. And Jehoiakim doesn't have the heart and passion of Josiah, but some of the things stay. And so we get to some of the practices stay. So we get to Jeremiah 7 at this point. And I want to just, so this is in the time of early in the reign of Jehoiakim. Remember I said that the book of Jeremiah is not linear, which is super confusing. So like the reign of the different kings, it's sprinkled throughout because that's not how Jeremiah was organized. It wasn't organized at here's the beginning and here's the end. It was organized by subject matter, okay, and by some other things that I have no idea. But it was organized not in a linear way. So we're going to hop to 7, and then we're going to hop briefly to 26, and those are both stories that came from the same era. Okay, so in chapter 7, the word of the Lord comes to Jeremiah, stand at the gate of the Lord's house at the temple, okay, and proclaim this message. Hear the word of the Lord, all you people of Judah who come through these gates to worship the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Reform your ways and your actions, and I will let you live in this place. Do not trust in deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. There was a popular either worship song or campaign slogan that seems to be used regularly in the temple. Okay? And it might not sound that different from songs that we sing today. God is great, God is great, God is great. But he says, hold on, hold on. Verse 5, if you really change your ways and your actions and deal with each other justly, if you do not oppress the foreigner, the fatherless, or the widow, and don't shed innocent blood in this place, if you do not follow other gods to your own harm, then I will let you live in this place, in the land I gave your ancestors forever and ever. But look, you are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. Will you steal and murder, commit adultery and perjury, burn incense to Baal and follow other gods you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house which bears my name and say, we are safe? Safe to do all these detestable things? Has this house which bears my name become a den of robbers to you? Jesus quotes that later when he cleanses the temple. But I have been watching, declares the Lord. Interesting, watching. Remember last week, that word for watch, it comes back in here again. The same word for almond stick, or the word play on almond stick. So Jeremiah declares that, and in the back of his mind, he's like, Lord, I'm saying some really, really spicy words here. So I trust that you're watching me as I declare that you're watching them, because this is going to get ugly if you're not protecting me here. And so what we get is this story, and remember that there is a lot of judgment in the book of Jeremiah. God's people had removed themselves from the way of God completely, and so Jeremiah's message to them is, listen, if you don't look any different than any of the other nations, I can't shape you into something different so that you can bless all the other nations. So I'm going to be removing my protection during this season, and you will go the way of your own violence and your own greed. And so the Babylonians, you know they're knocking on the door above from the north. They're going to come and they're going to overtake you because they're stronger. And you're just living right now the way of everybody else. And so that's what's going to happen. You're going to die the way of everybody else. And so it's really hard sometimes for us to make the cultural leap to understand this world and the worldviews that are sometimes represented here. But just know that that's the context. So he says this message, and what he's essentially saying is, listen, you guys, you got the form correct. You found the book of Deuteronomy. You got all the worship form correct. The temple looks great. But guess what? The rest of your lives are the same as they've always been. You're still oppressing people. You're still giving in to violent ways. You're continuing to do the same things that show that your back has been turned toward me. You're not loving one another. You're not welcoming the alien. And the foreigner at some other points in Jeremiah is such a huge theme. You're not doing the things that I called you to do as a people. But yet you come in and you say, we are in the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, temple of the Lord. Dietrich Bonhoeffer called it cheap grace. Paul says, what, should you go on sinning so the grace can abound more? Is this what you think? Apparently there was a faction of people saying, we've gotten it figured out. This is great. The temple has been restored, and this is all that matters. And now we can live however we want the rest of the week. And so Jeremiah gets this awful burden of having to declare, no, no, you're still killing each other. You're still treating each other unfairly. You're still choosing to exclude. You're still choosing to worship other gods. You're still choosing radical, terrible forms of immorality. It's not enough. Same time, similar story. Right here, we don't get the response, by the way. We don't find out exactly what people do, all right? But we do find that out in Jeremiah 26. So in Jeremiah 26, early in the reign of Jehoiakim, we get a similar story. Son of Josiah, king of Judah, this word came from the Lord. Okay, it's a similar idea. This is what you should do. Go stand in the courtyard of the Lord's house. So first he was standing on the threshold of the temple at the entrance. Now he's moved in a little bit to the courtyard, moving closer to the heart of things. And speak to the people in the towns of Judah who come to worship in the house. Tell them everything I commanded you. Don't omit a word. Perhaps they will listen. Listen to this. And each will turn from their evil ways. Then I'll relent. Relent means I'll move in a different direction and not inflict on them the disaster I was planning because of the evil that they have done. Remember again what I said earlier about that. We can quickly paint this picture of God as a wrathful God that's full of vengeance. But we see that the language here that's consistent throughout the Old Testament points to a removal of God's protection at this point because he later declares judgment on Babylon. So it's inconsistent for us to say that God just took this country, Babylon, and just forced them to invade Israel, but that they had no hand in it themselves. Babylon was choosing evil, and God was saying, I'm not going to protect you anymore. That's what the story is saying. You will experience this disaster because you are not acting as my people at all. It's a hard thing to read, and we know that Jesus does change things, thankfully, so that we can live in a new reality for sure. So that's what's happening. So the priests, the prophets, and all the people, finally, we get some responses. They heard Jeremiah speak these words in the house of the Lord. But as soon as Jeremiah finished telling all the people everything the Lord had commanded him, the priests, the prophets, and the people, see, they used alliteration even back then, seized him and said, you must die. That's English, by the way. This was written in Hebrew, so that's okay. You must die. Why do you prophesy in the Lord's name that this house will be like Shiloh? We don't need that backstory. And this city will be desolate and deserted. And all the people crowded around Jeremiah in the house of the Lord. So we have critique number one from Jeremiah. And there is a response. And the first response is that they're about to have a temple murder. Right? The first response is, you must die. It's about par for the course sometimes, isn't it? Secondly, there's another response that comes just a few verses later. The officials and all the people said to the priests and the prophets, hold on, this man should not be sentenced to death. He's spoken to us in the name of the Lord. Some of the elders step forward, and then they tell the story of Micah, the prophet Micah. And they say, he prophesied, and he was not put to death. And they give a quote, Zion will be plowed like a field. He said this. He said some things that nobody wanted to hear, but Hezekiah did not put him to death, and didn't then the Lord relent. And so, in other words, they say, we're about to bring a terrible disaster on ourselves. So the first faction says, kill him. Second one says, hold on. Maybe we need to listen in light of who he is and what he's saying. Same message, two vastly different response. One hears anything that disrupts their comfort level and way of life, and immediately they want to execute Jeremiah. The others, they think a little. They realize who Jeremiah is and the relationship that they have with them. Aren't these two ways that we can often hear and handle critique? One is that we wish death on them. I'll just say them. Isn't that one way we can handle critique? Whether we ever say it or not. We wish death on you. You're not allowed to criticize me. You're not allowed to say anything that I don't want to hear. That's one way. The second way, however, that we see as an example here is they pause and they consider. Let's listen to what's being said. Let's be careful that we are not blinded by our own self-deception. Let's just hold back a moment. Let's listen. We can pause to consider the words with an ear to the Spirit and a deep desire to not miss an opportunity to align ourselves with God's hope for the world. This is challenging, but I am asking us to learn how to really listen. Listen to each other. Listen to the Spirit. And honestly, we need to do a better job of listening to the critique from the world around us. Listening to the pain of those who have been on the receiving end of stones lobbed from afar. The church has not done a great job of this, friends. We've been pretty quick to hear the critique from the outside world and wish death on them. Rather than pause and consider, Maybe there's truth. Maybe we need to hear this. About 4 years ago, a song got huge on the top 40 charts. It was a song by a musician named Hozier. And the song was called Take Me to Church. Okay? And the song was his own perspective. It was a scathing critique of the organized church mixed with a metaphor of seeing his lover as the object of worship that is actually the only thing that brings any true meaning. So he puts his lover in place of the church because the church has only brought death to him and his lover brings life. And many in the church were quick to wish death upon him because the song certainly has a completely different value system, without a doubt, than a Christ follower. However, maybe we need to pause and consider. In his critique, he talks about every Sunday is more bleak with fresh poison each week. And while I'm not going to pick apart the whole song, there's a haunting line in the chorus that says, I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. And I know that's opened a lot of different interpretations. But when I see that and when I hear that, and for 4 years it's stuck in my head, that this is the critique of someone who has been on the outside or who's been on the inside at one point and experienced something that put them on the outside. And what that experience was that when our brokenness is known, when our sin is known, the desire of Christians is to crucify, is to cut deep. And see, what happens when we hear critique and what we choose to do is shut it out and wish death upon them, like the prophets did to Isaiah or did to Jeremiah. What we do is we remove ourselves from the opportunity to be self-reflective enough to move just a little bit more toward the mark. Okay? And so it is absolutely crucial that we move in this direction. Maybe we shouldn't call for Hozier's death just yet. Maybe we have something to learn. Let's listen in humility, knowing that God often speaks to us in ways that are uncomfortable for us to hear. As people of Jesus, we have only one option for how we handle critique: humbly. That's it. That's the only option you get. You can disagree, but not without humility. So, in light of that, what happens when you move to the other side of the line? What happens when you have to be the ones to speak prophetically and offer challenge and critique? By the way, if you find yourself getting really excited about this part, about when it's your turn to bring the critique and name the problem, I have a little advice for you. Can you keep your mouth shut? I want to invite you to not practice this yet. Instead, you should sit with Jesus a little bit longer. This sort of thing wrecked Jeremiah, wrecked him, to the point of desperation, crying on the ground, screaming, God, take my life. I can't even handle this. Bringing critique in an honest way is painful, and we should not relish it. Let's be aware of this. Jeremiah didn't want to. He was compelled to. This is really simple, but let's just put it up here so that we don't... Whoops, I just dropped a wheel. That works. Probably helps. All right. If that's all we see from this morning, we are good. We must walk humbly. I find it interesting. We have to, one way when we are on in a position of feeling like it's necessary to offer critique in our world, we have a couple of things that we must do. And the first thing is that we must not separate ourselves from others in an us-them sort of approach. I find it fascinating that we have no example that Jeremiah himself participated in any of these atrocities. Quite the opposite. Jeremiah was seen as a holy person who had a very high character. And yet here's what we hear in chapter 14, verse 7. And Jeremiah is crying out, although our sins testify against us, O Lord, do something for the sake of your name. For our backsliding is great. We have sinned against you. Again in verse 20 of chapter 14. O Lord, we acknowledge our wickedness and the guilt of our fathers. We have sinned against you. See, there's this idea of saying, I am willing to place myself and self-identify with the brokenness. I'm not standing here from afar and lobbing stones. I'm instead saying, yeah, boy, these realities are hard for all of us. I'm certainly not outside of the need for correction, encouragement, hope. Over and over again, Isaiah 53, 6 says, we like sheep have gone astray, all of us, right? We are in a shared experience of missing the mark. Jesus helps us see the realities here in some dynamic ways in his ministry. When we engage in critique, as I've reflected on this, there are two dangerous risks for us when we do critique. On one side, let's go back here. On one side, of critique, we can fall off the ledge. It's like, oh man, I don't do mountains well. Okay. All right. It's terrible. So there's a little snow cap. Looks like the Grinch. What's that mountain called? Does anybody remember that? Maybe our hearts will grow three sizes today. So on one end, if you fall off of courageous critique and healthy critique, on one side is you become hyper-critical. And on the other side, you become, anybody get it? Yeah, hypocritical. They're actually both sides of the same coin, but we can become, if we're not careful, we can become hypercritical on one side and we lose it. Or we can become hypocritical on the other side and we lose it. So I find it fascinating that when Jesus is talking about the Pharisees, again, offering critique to the religious leaders, one of his critiques of them is the hypercritical attitude. They tie up heavy, cumbersome loads. These are the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And they put them on other people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. You say, you just criticize over and over. You tell people they don't measure up over and over and over again, but you're not doing a thing to help them move forward? Absolutely not. You shut the door of the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. You yourselves don't enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. You've become so critical that all you can do is point out faults. And even people that are longing, imperfect people that are longing for the kingdom, you stand in their way with your criticism and your arrogance. It's dangerous. And then in Matthew 7, in the Sermon on the Mount, which is really the center of our understanding of the Christian life. Not really, it is the center of our understanding of the Christian life, the primary teachings of Jesus. Jesus says about the hypocritical life, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, hey, let me take that speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. The word in Greek there, it means an actor. You actor. First take the plant out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. You get the blatant, ridiculous image of this, right? You get that there's this, like, this 2x4 on this guy's head. And he's like knocking people over as he says, hey, I think you got a little something in your eye. Whack! This is supposed to be ridiculous. Jesus is saying this is outlandish. This is how you need to think of yourselves. Notice he doesn't say that there's never a time and place to help your friend get a speck out of their eye. But he says if you don't get the fact that you got just as many issues, and that's not a part of acknowledging it, you're never, ever going to actually make progress and be effective. Let's be aware of this. By the way, did you notice that the conversation here is either directed toward the religious leaders or toward the disciples among themselves? This is really, really important as we talk about critique. In 1 Corinthians 5, Paul is writing back and forth to the church in Corinth, and they've had all of these really bad issues, like really bad issues, like mother-in-laws and sons doing things they should not be doing together and all sorts of things. And Paul is like, where have you guys somehow completely misunderstood the way of Jesus? You're fighting with each other. You're taking each other to court, all this over and over again. And so they've had conversations about what's going on, and they write back because Paul says, listen, when there is someone that is completely out of line and claiming that they are in Jesus and mistreating people and doing this and that and that and saying that there's no problem with it, you need to distance yourself from them. It's going to hurt your witness. And they write back and they've misunderstood. Apparently, we don't have the letters that the Corinthians wrote to Paul. And when they write to him, they say, hey, just apparently, they say, so we're not supposed to connect with anybody that's like overtly dealing with sin? And he writes back and he's like, no, I'm not talking about the world around you. I'm talking about you guys as a community. If I was talking about the world around you, you wouldn't even be able to be present with people. And obviously, you're supposed to be present with people. So Paul clarifies that, listen, your critique is intended to be in-house, by and large. Most of the time, this is working with each other and calling each other to a better way. Interesting, historically, the church has seen a lot of the letters of Paul and has decided that we're going to take those and we're going to throw them at the people outside of the church and judge them for it. And Paul says, hold on, that's not what I'm talking about. You're supposed to treat people who have not chosen to follow Jesus with gentleness and respect and invite them into a better way. But those who claim Jesus, this is where there might be time to speak strongly sometimes, because otherwise they're going to kill your ability to show the world what Jesus is like. And so we need to remember that a lot of this stuff is not about critiquing the outside world constantly and telling everybody where they're screwed up when they're not even asking. It's about the church following Jesus together, first starting to be humble and transform each other and ourselves through loving, gentle, humble encouragement, not to the outside world. The church has taken pleasure in the sinfulness of the world around them for far too long. We have been the hypocritical and the hypercritical, relishing our own righteous indignation of that dirty world out there while subtly falling prey to a whole host of equally damning sins of pride and arrogance and judgmentalism and hypocrisy. We have given people reasons to write songs like Take Me to Church, sarcastically looking at what the church has sometimes become, offering no real life, only criticism and shame toward the world around us. We have not looked at our own brokenness first. We have not realized that a healthy critique can only be born out of honest humility, where we recognize that we are a part of the problem and that the grace that extends from Jesus to my neighbor and my enemy extends to them every bit as much as it extends to me. We need to be the paramedics that dress the wounds of the world around us rather than the knife bearers that are inflicting it. That's our calling. And if you want to argue, I'll play my own devil's advocate here for a minute. If you want to argue that no, we have to be the ones declaring God's judgment on the world, I would just reference you to Luke 4, where Jesus opens up the scroll of Isaiah 61. And he reads his mission statement. It's his first public words of ministry. And he reads Luke 4 and he says, the Spirit of the Lord is on me because he's anointed me to preach good news to the poor and set the prisoners free and recovery of sight to the blind and freedom for the oppressed. And he says all these things. And he ends it with, and proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And he closes the scroll. He's quoting Isaiah 61. At that point in Isaiah 61, there's a comma. And it continues. He stops mid-sentence. There's not a comma. It just continues. There's no commas in Hebrew. Sorry, I don't like misspeaking. So I was using too much emphasis there for dramatic effect. The second half of that sentence is in Isaiah, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's wrath. Jesus says, my mission is to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Because what the religious folks are doing is they're pushing all of this wrath on you and they're pushing all of this judgment. I'm here to actually say Jesus is on your side. God is on your side, inviting you into a better life, inviting you into a more hopeful reality. We get to live in that. That doesn't mean that we don't ever talk about things that bring death and break down life. But what it means is that our ultimate goal is to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor because we are Jesus followers. Okay? So that's where we come out as a church. All right, I want to leave you with two final encouragements. The first one is that if we are ever to critique in the prophetic tradition, it must always end with hope. It must always end with hope. Even in Jeremiah, whose book is full of these scathing critiques, you cannot escape the hope. Is that rain? Oh, praise God. Oh my goodness, do we ever need some rain. I'm sorry if any of you left your windows down, but we really need this rain. We really need this rain. That's excellent. Okay, hope. It's hopeful. Yeah. All right. We have to end with hope. In the often quoted, but often out of contextually quoted passage of Jeremiah 29 in verse 11, Jeremiah proclaims, after Babylon has come and after God's people have been scattered, he proclaims to those who are trying to be faithful, a few of them who have been taken out of their land, he proclaims, I'm not done with you. I have hope. There's a future. I will continue to work with you. Believe me. All is not lost. All was never lost. Continue to seek me and you will find me. It's a promise that's found in Jeremiah and in a whole bunch of other places in the scriptures. So we never ever lose hope in our critique. We always hope. We always talk about how there's a better reality out there. And we join in helping walk with one another toward it. It's beautiful. The second encouragement is one that I see practiced in the life of Jesus and in the life of the first century church. A huge part of their critique of a world that was drunk on violence and selfishness and oppression and greed and anger was this. The way they critiqued that, they just lived a more beautiful story. In fact, at the end of the book of Jeremiah, or at the end of chapter 7 of Jeremiah, do I have it? No, I don't have it. At the end of the chapter 7 in Jeremiah, I love this, and it's really worth hearing. It's not at the end, it's in the middle. It's at the end of the section that we were talking about. He's talking about all that they're doing and that they're provoking God's anger. But in verse 19 of Jeremiah 7, God says through Jeremiah, but am I the one that they're provoking, declares the Lord? Are they not rather harming themselves to their own shame? So like deep down, like, is this just some random rule of God that you have to follow? No, I've laid out a certain way because this is the best way to live, honestly. So when you turn away, you're harming yourself. You're not just disobeying some kind of random subjective law that God decided one day, and so that's why you have to follow it. God laid out a way of life that is about compassion and care and forgiveness and self-control that is beautiful and good. And so one of the ways that the early church lived out their critique of the world around them was by living a story that was so beautiful that people could not help notice it and find it more attractive. That's why in Romans 12, when Paul's talking and he says, it's his like summation of Jesus' Sermon on the Mountain. He says, if your enemy's hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing so, you'll heap burning coals on his head. That was a figure of speech that said, in doing so, they'll see that their behavior is really not the best way to live because you're continuing to love in the midst of it. I heard a story of one of you this week who had a heated exchange with one of your family members who had made some real mistakes. And the family member was accusatory and angry and all sorts of things, and you continued to be patient and kind and compassionate in the midst of that conversation. That is living a better story. That is saying, I'm not going to match pitch with you. We're not going to live in the same anger as the rest of the world around us or the same greed. Even sometimes our critique of others can be just as angry as whatever they were angry about that we're angry that they're angry about. And so then we just don't accomplish anything good and beautiful. Let's be people who live a better story and a truer story. And I don't mean that arrogantly. I mean, let's be people who choose to live in such a way that others around us say, oh, I desire that. Doesn't mean life's easy, but I desire to see love and care and forgiveness like that. That's a better choice than my reality. Maybe I should forgive too. What's your foundation? Why are you able to have peace in the midst of turmoil? Jesus, okay, maybe I need to seek out that too. There's something beautiful there. All right, friends. Critique is a part of a faithful life. Sometimes we need to hear it, and unfortunately, sometimes we need to give it. So let's pray, and then I'll put a couple questions up if we want to respond to it for 2 or 3 minutes. Father, this is tough stuff to think about. Thanks for shaping us in the midst of this. Give us humility. Whatever side we find ourselves on in terms of critique, give us humility, God. Help us to have the character of Jesus in everything that we do. We need you for this. This is not easy. Amen.